Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A battle space in that war, which is not widely understood as such, alas, is the entire phenomenon, really, of the social media, one of the most important elements of which is Google and the various companies like YouTube that it has pulled into its organization over the years. A man who has recently come out, if you will, of Google with documentation about what it is up to that should be very concerning to all of us who particularly understand the stakes in what I call the war for the free world, is Zach Voorhees. He is a software engineer by training, worked at Google for some 8.5 years, and then at one of its subsidiaries, YouTube, as a senior software engineer there for another 3 or so. He has recently, with the help of Project Veritas, brought to our attention, as I say, issues with respect to the management and the agenda of Google that should be very concerning to those of us who know that the free world has to win this particular war, but not necessarily is it a given. Zach Voorhees, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you for giving us a full hour of your time to really drill down on what you discovered in the course of your employment with Google and what the rest of us need to know about it. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's our honor. I guess I might just ask you to sort of set the stage for us, if you will, for this conversation by telling us what is Google? I mean, what is its business model? How does it operate? How has it garnered such immense wealth and dominant position in the social media space?
Yeah, so Google came to prominence because they were able to discover a new business model, which was to search the internet and pull up relevant links to websites with a preview of what that website was and deliver that to the customer better than any other company in existence. Prior to that, we had Yahoo search, but it just wasn't like search just wasn't a really good feature. It was sort of a feature that was bolted on. And from what I've heard, the executive team never thought of search as something that could ever make the company money. And so they didn't think of it as something that was, you know, part of their core business model. Well, Google changed all that with an algorithm called Backlink or Backrub, which saw how many times a website was linked by other websites and then used that information to generate an importance score for a website. The more links, the higher the importance, the higher the results when users would search for it.
And to some extent, as I understand it, that then began to be commercially a very important means of generating revenue. How did that come about?
It came about primarily through, I think it's like Stanford where they came out of, people just started using it and they're like, this is amazing. And pretty much everyone that used it said, you know, this was the best thing ever. And
this thing being the Google search engine.
The Google search engine just spread virally. And suddenly everyone seemed that like within a span of 2 years, everyone just stopped using all the other search engines and primarily switched to Google's thing. And then this was great because all of a sudden people could find information like they had never been able to find it before.
But then as a revenue generating vehicle, how did that work and come about?
The way that it worked was they were able to generate advertising that would pop up in front of the links. And the ads would pop up as you were searching. And if you clicked on those ads, then you would go to that person's page and Google would get like a dime or nickel or quarter each time someone did a click. It's what we call a pay-per-click model of advertising on the internet.
But there's an intermediate step, as I understand it, and I don't know beans about this, Zach, so I'm appreciative of your walking through this Google 101 with me. But there was a feature, I assume, that involved data collection that enabled them to begin really making this a money-generating scheme, that the more they knew about what you were searching for, the more they could get a profile of you, the more they knew what kind of advertising you might be particularly susceptible to. Am I right?
Yeah, so there was like an open secret, even though Google didn't really talk about selling user data, there was this open secret that they were. And we summed it up really nicely with a saying in Silicon Valley, which is, if the product is free, you are the product. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense in a certain, you know, abstract way. But just, again, I'm just trying to figure out, because this became really the booster rocket, didn't it, for this whole Silicon Valley dynamic, whereby it was all about you and your information and what could be done to exploit that information. In terms of how this thing got started, they had a business model that said, we're going to help you find things on the internet. In exchange for that, because it was free, you would give them essentially insights into who you were, what you liked, what you were searching for, of course. And then that began to be commercial?
Well, I mean, no, they've always been logging the user search behavior when someone interacts on their site. I mean, they use that in order to improve their search results. So, for example, if there is a link on the fifth page and that's the one that you click on and you spend a really long time there before coming back to the Google search engine to find your next thing, then Google is going to realize that that link is important because you spent so much time on it.
And that you're the kind of person who would spend time rather than just move very swiftly through. That might tell you different pieces of your demographic profile, perhaps as well as your interests. Zach, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to talk with you about how this interest in your private information sort of became a consuming passion for Google and what it has meant for the political program of the Google leadership. That and much more with Zach Voorhees right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Zach Voorhees is with us. I've come to know him a little bit lately and wanted to share his insights with all of you because I find fascinating what he's able to tell us about the company for whom he worked for 11 years between the parent company and its subsidiary, YouTube. I'm talking about Google. He is perhaps best known at the moment as the Google whistleblower. You can see much of what he's done to date at the website of our friends at Project Veritas. Is there any other website that you would like to drive people to, Zach?
Yeah, people can follow me at Twitter/PerpetualManiac. That is my username right there, Perpetual Maniac. And I'm fighting dragons, specifically Google. And so I need help.
You do, and Perpetual Maniac is the way to find you on Twitter. So let me just develop this basic sort of foundation of what you are fighting the dragon that you are most immediately fighting. Zach Voorhees, we talked in the previous segment a bit about how you came to Google and how it grew up initially as a search engine, ultimately interested in and quite successful at gaining information and insights into not just the user experience, but the user as well, and how that became part of the business model for, you know, enriching the company and building more capacity. When you turned up at Google, where was it in this arc? It wasn't the behemoth it is today, I gather, but what was your perception of the company that you were going to work for at the time?
So when I started there in 2008, Google was at its heyday. The media was talking about it. They were saying how great it was to work at the company, how you know, amazing the food was, how they gave out free massages, how they allowed people to spend 20% of their time working on their own projects. And, you know, I went there and I certainly had a really great time working at Google. I can confirm that, you know, all the things that it was a really different and really fun place to work. It was a terrific experience. I think that it was around 16,000 employees when I started. Now it's over 100,000. So it's grown quite a bit.
It has indeed. And in terms of this business about obtaining and making use of the information of individuals who are using its services for free, as you say, meaning that they're the product, that data about them, how did Google go about optimizing its understanding of these individuals and their characteristics for the purposes of again, making money, at least initially?
I mean, they kept on getting larger, right? Like, you know, the search market was getting larger because more people were, you know, turning to computers in order to, you know, find information that they were looking for. And I feel that search technology is kind of like steel. It has a multiplicative effect on the economy and allows the economy to operate more efficiently because, you know, suppliers are able to find buyers and, you know, vice versa. And, you know, people are able to find communities that they want to join. And so there's this, you know, there was this migration of people as a cultural event, how we started to use computers for every aspect of our life. And as a result, Google's, you know, profits increased as advertisers started leaving, you know, classical media, TV, print, and started moving towards, advertising on Google's search engine, you know, and then when they bought YouTube, YouTube started to monetize its user base by selling ads right in the video itself, so that before a video would load, you would see like a 5 second, 15 second ad. And this started to, you know, generate a significant amount of revenue for the company. And then they also had military contracts. I know this as I used to work for Google Earth, and we had some enterprise clients. And I strongly believe that those enterprise clients included people in the defense industry. As more people started using their products, obviously their profits soared. And that brings us all the way to, you know, recent times, you know, where now Google is a giant behemoth of a company.
Well, before we get into the implications of that, let's just, again, set the stage here. Over the time that you were there, surely you became aware of the sort of political or ideological, if you will, leanings of not just your immediate colleagues, but the leadership of the company as well. Were you sort of a mind with them, and how would you characterize their general leanings in those sort of spaces?
They were always like sort of leftist. Leftist used to mean liberal, and I consider myself a liberal. I still do, at least a classical liberal. But Google started to abandon their liberal principles in 2016. They had this weird test that had been going on for like a decade, and it was called the implicit association test. And this is like one of the weird things I noticed was this test would test you on how implicitly racist you were based upon this computer game that was a challenge response. Like it'd say like, you know, click this area on the screen, and from, you know, clicking different things that contain words and trying to like pattern match, this program would tell you what your implicit biases are, how racist you were. And they even said that, like, hey, if you think that you aren't a racist person, you're not going to like the results of this test. You know, just to you know, push it out how this test operated. In 2017, the Wall Street Journal published a scathing article showing that the implicit association test was actually completely junk science, that it wasn't testing implicit racism, it was just testing familiarity. As a result, Google's like, okay, we're not going to run this test anymore. But the damage had already been done. Like, this test had been administered tens of thousands of times to the employees at Google, possibly even more than that, in fact. And I thought that it was really illiberal for Google to talk about, you know, to try to convince us that we were actually racist people, especially with a debunked test.
And what was the purpose in doing that, as you saw it in practice, Zach? Was it to you know, try to purge from the company people who were racists, or was it again just simply to begin influencing, you know, your thinking and behavior?
That, I think it was the latter. I think it was designed to influence our behavior. I think that, you know, that there was possibly always the intention of an agenda to censor the internet. And before they could do that, they needed to have a priming event to prime us so that we would accept our role as censors of the internet and be okay with the company doing it. And so, you know, this is, looking back, I think this is the reason why they had the implicit association test.
So this brings up sort of the crux of the matter. The leadership of Google was, at some point in the course of this period you were there, transforming itself into an instrument for censoring the internet. Were there any other things that were agenda items, and is there any particular reason why 2016 seems to have been such a pivotal moment?
Yeah, it was the year that Donald Trump got elected, and that's when they took their censorship regime and went from 0 to 60 immediately. They stepped on the gas, and everything within the company like changed almost overnight.
Well, I really want to talk about, you know, what you saw after that moment, but just again in the run up to it, what was the level of engagement as you saw it, to the extent you can comment on it, of the company as a company in the 2016 election itself? Obviously, they were jarred by what happened, but were they engaged in it prior to the election itself?
Yeah, it turns out that they were engaged. They did have a nascent censorship regime that had already been on there, but no one knew about it. No one was really writing about Google censorship. We still thought that they were, you know, an unbiased company, and, you know, but they were hiding some things about the Clinton Foundation, which were disconcerting. But, you know, at that time, it wasn't really activated on that censorship because I didn't think that the claims against Hillary Clinton were necessarily true. And it wasn't until later that I would become aware that they were true. But at the time, there was some sort of meddling going on with the search results being suppressed around Hillary Clinton, that when you would type something in like Clinton body counts to try to find the famous graph of all the people that have been killed by Hillary Clinton, which is around like 60, that was being suppressed. And
we have to pause, Zach, for his, we'll be right back with more. Let's just say people she is alleged to have killed, according to this visual aid. But it's a fascinating question as to what was being done to the search results. And that's where we're going to pick up with Zach on the other side of this very brief break. Zach Voorhees, the Google whistleblower, and more straight after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Zach Voorhees is our guest for this full hour. He is shedding light on one of the most important companies in America from the perspective of a man who worked for it and its subsidiary for some 11 years. His name is Zach Voorhees. He is the Google whistleblower. And we're going to talk a little bit about how he knows so much about this, both from his own personal experience and from some important documents that he obtained and has now made available to us all. But Zach, before we get to the documents, just quickly, you introduced this thought that even before the election of Donald Trump, Google was beginning to manipulate search results unbeknownst to the users. And this was to obscure some of the problems that might have caused Hillary Clinton to suffer at the ballot box. Were they also trying to actually harm Donald Trump's candidacy, as best you can tell?
Best as I can tell, yes. There was a lot of negative information. I mean, the whole media system seemed to turn against Donald Trump. So it's hard to know what part was Google's amplification of that and just the overwhelming amount of negative publicity that was being generated on Trump.
But is it fair to say that whatever the underlying reality was, Google was, even before the election, beginning to help amplify it, but that paled by comparison, I take it, to what happened once he became president or was elected,
yeah,
at least in the transition?
That's right.
And what did you see in that regard in terms of this ramping up? And maybe you could just introduce us to some of the documents that have shed light on this as well.
Yeah. So right after he got elected, Google held a meeting. First off, the company culture was very upset at Donald Trump winning the election. Then what happened was,
when you say company culture, sorry, just a clarification, you mean what you were getting in the way of top-down guidance from the leadership, or do you mean the sort of masses of the employees of the company in their own right?
Masses of the employees in their own right. As I walked through the halls, people were really upset. Yeah. So, the company culture was obviously upset at Donald Trump winning the election. I thought it was hilarious that he won. I'm not a big fan of the government and all the lying that it's done, the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, all the countries that we've just destroyed. So I'm actually really happy that, you know, a monkey wrench is being thrown into the gears. And I'm like, well, you know, this is hilarious, you know. And I thought that it was just going to be, you know, okay, we had an election, business as usual, but it turned out that it was not going to be business as usual. About a week after Trump won the election, there was this all hands company meeting that Google did. And it was its executive team, including the CEO, the CFO, chairman of the board, Sergey Brin. They all sat down and had a face-to-face, almost like a fireside chat.
And the audience was the whole employee cohort?
Well, yeah, it was available to stream. There was a large, because, you know, we're a multi-campus area, so If you're in Mountain View, then you can actually go and see the live presentation. If you're anywhere else, then you stream in and you just see the live stream. And this live stream was really disconcerting to me because, you know, the reaction of the executives was very, 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 very surprising. The CEO, actually the chairman, Sergey Brin, the founder, Sergey Brin said that he was personally offended at the election of Donald Trump. The CFO broke down in tears saying, you know, how we had lost the election, which I thought was a really weird statement given that, you know, it wasn't their candidate. I don't know how they could lose the election. But, and then the CEO, Sundar Pichai, said that one of the successful things that they had done in the election was use their machine learning algorithms to suppress fake news. And that was actually really interesting to me. I was like, wait a minute, we're using machine learning to suppress fake news. Who decides what's fake news? You know, because if there's fake news, there needs to be an arbitrator there to decide what's real and what's false. So I started to dig, and I'm kind of a sleuth myself. I like to investigate. So I started to investigate on the public internal documents of the company. And I found this document about fake news. And in it, there were actual events that had taken place that were being labeled as fake. For example, Hillary running weapons to fund ISIS in Syria, I knew was a real story. People had come out and said that this had taken place. But Google, you know, here I saw Google in a presentation saying that this was fake news. And I said, well, how do they know it's fake? And what about all those other people that are, you know, saying that it's true? And I was like, maybe they're not really trying to eliminate fake news. Maybe they're trying to just control the information landscape. And so I started digging further and further and further because, you know, if there's fake news and there's something that needs to decide what is fake and, you know, suppress it. And I found it. And the name of that program was called Machine Learning Fairness.
Now, let me ask you, if I can, just at the risk of digressing just for a minute, but your own sleuthing, your own investigation, which pointed to a policy direction that lent itself to manipulation for political purposes, I guess, if I hear you right, seems to track pretty closely with what Dr. Robert Epstein found in his independent analysis without the benefit of your insights from inside or the documents that you were looking at. I trust that you're familiar with his work. And does this more or less confirm his analysis and for that matter, his work confirm yours?
I mean, I just want to say that Dr. Robert Epstein is right on the money about everything that he is disclosing about what's happening with Google. And I personally saw that I personally confirmed his thesis and confirmed that it was happening. And actually part of my disclosure to the general public was to Dr. Robert Epstein so that he could get validation for the things that he was saying because Google was slandering Dr. Epstein with the label of a conspiracy theorist. And this was really amazing given that, you know, he's a Harvard-trained psychologist and the former editor-in-chief of Psychology Today. And he knows how to run a study. And to call this guy a conspiracy theorist and just throw that label around is slanderous. I mean, this is someone that we should be listening to and figuring out whether his assertions are valid or not just blanket dismissing him with a pejorative. So yes, I do confirm everything that Dr. Robert Epstein is saying is true.
Well, this is very troubling because I've interviewed him on this program in the past, and certainly he's appeared in many other places. And what he is describing, Zach Voorhees, is an organization that has immense power, even through some relatively seemingly innocuous techniques or algorithms or manipulations, to have a profound effect on public perceptions and even electoral outcomes. And I guess what you're confirming is, based on your own insights and experience, that's not an accident. That's the deliberate purpose of the company, and that it became much more aggressively engaged in pursuing that purpose after Donald Trump was elected president. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, you know, like I said, they've been ramping this up for a while with their, you know, implicit association test to measure internal biases. I believe that they were planning on unveiling this later, but then with Trump winning, they decided to, you know, go full throttle and ramp up their efforts in this. Robert Epstein has been taking a black box approach in order to monitor Google and also some of his own tests of bringing people that are neutral and being able to flip their opinion on an idea 90% in either direction, depending just simply by hiding the search results. So Dr. Robert Epstein has been, you know, on this for a very long time, I think since 2015 or earlier.
Well, really, the question that looms here, of course, is if Google has that intention and can influence people's perceptions and thinking and ultimately their votes, what is it likely to look like, again, all other things being equal, if they're able to pursue that ambition relentlessly in the course of the coming 2020 election, given their evident hostility to Donald Trump and their determination to stop him? That's the topic that I want to turn to when we return after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of our very, very important conversation with the Google whistleblower. His name is Zach Voorhees. So I want to just pick up where we left off there. You saw what happened in the period after the election of Donald Trump, and that in the intervening period, as Dr. Robert Epstein has documented, the company has made considerable strides in terms of its ability to operationalize its political influence operation. How do you anticipate this is going to play out in the course of the 2020 election? Will Google be actually able to influence this election to a point where they can change the results in at least key areas?
I mean, you see that they're already doing it. Like, look what they're doing to Tulsi Gabbard. They're suppressing her like crazy. You know, there was a Democratic debate, and Tulsi did really well in it. And after the debate, everyone was trying to search for Tulsi Gabbard. Well, what happened was her ad account that she was using to make sure that she was at the top of the search results, her ad account went down for 6 hours immediately following the debate.
Like, as in crashed?
It went down as in they deactivated it. And they said that it's been deactivated due to suspicious activity. And I actually talked to her lawyer about it, and I said that it looked very similar to how a pattern of takedowns that I've seen in the past for people like Jordan Peterson, and that the way that they were taken down was by a known exploit that third-party insiders are able to exploit to take down anyone that they want. And so I believe that, you know, Google, in order to wipe its hands of liability, has given plausible deniability by allowing these bugs inside of the system to be used by other people outside of the company in order to pull people and just kick them off the, you know, their ad accounts or their YouTube videos and take them down. And the way that it works, you know, in this case is that if you had a target email address, you know, let's take frankgaffney@gmail, and then I take your email address and I create a new email address with one letter change, like maybe we've got like three F's in it. And I keep on doing this over and over and over again until I create a network of spam accounts. Those spam accounts then start pushing spam out through its email system. Well, that's going to cause the AI system to take down an account, all the accounts that are spam, and also the target account, which looks like those as well.
When you say this is artificial intelligence, as in this machine learning initiative, is that right?
Not within machine learning, but it's within the AI. I just call it AI, even though it's actually an algorithm. I just use AI because people understand AI. They don't know what algorithm means, but it's an AI. It takes down all the accounts that look similar to each other, including the target account. And this is a well-known bug. They haven't really done anything about it. They may have done something about it now that I've brought attention to it, but this is certainly the indication of what I think is how they took down Tulsi, just like a whole bunch of other accounts have been taken down.
And if they would do that to a Democratic candidate for the presidency, how much more likely is it that they would do it, and heaven knows what else, to this Republican one who is clearly detested by the leadership and cohort?
Exactly. Like, they're willing to do this to the DNC. Just imagine what they're going to do to the Republicans. So Tulsi goes down. And then just this last week, there was, I think Tulsi like scored some sort of PR victory against someone else, and YouTube took down or suppressed her videos. But here's the thing. They only suppressed her videos in the United States. So people that were in the UK or people that were in Russia, they were seeing that there was no suppression. But then they would VPN, which is a way of making it look like you're in the United States by tunneling through and then accessing a website. So once they tunneled into the United States and then accessed YouTube, they saw the suppression. So despite all of this that I've exposed, Google is still engaging in suppression of a political candidate.
And at the end of the day, how worried should we be? This is not the only problem, of course, but it's a particularly immediate concern, it seems to me, Zach, and I gather to you too. If our very democracy may be subverted by the machinations of the company for which you previously worked, Google.
I mean, yeah, I think we should be worried. I think we should be very alarmed. And if you go out and look for other places where they've, you know, meddled in elections, you'll find that they meddled in the Irish constitutional election, where they censored the phrase, the Eighth Amendment, the Constitution of Ireland. Boom. Right. They censored that. During a constitutional amendment referendum. And then in Brazil, the Supreme Court ruled that Google had conspired with the opponent of the current president to slander President Bolsonaro and you know, push negative stories right to the top. You know, this is what the Supreme Court ruled. You know, and then if you look back and see Egypt during the Arab Spring, Egypt got overthrown briefly before a military dictatorship like came back into power after the Muslim Brotherhood was able to seize power. It turns out that the person that started that whole revolution was a Google employee that used to work for the CIA. And then if you go back even further, like to ISIS spreading their propaganda over Twitter and the Google networks, you know, people were, I think like the State Department was trying to get information about ISIS. And then, you know, these media companies came out and said, you know, we can't give out this, these people's information. That would set a dangerous precedent. Like, you know, that was like in 2015, you know, they couldn't even give away information about, you know, these terrorists. But now they're, you know, the bar has become so low that, you know, anyone that says a bad word can have their entire YouTube page deleted off the internet.
Google has lately, we're told the insistence of its workforce, refused to do work on Defense Department contracts. And yet, just yesterday, they signed a deal to do artificial intelligence work for Communist China, which will certainly be in the service of its military, among other ominous applications. Could you just give us your thoughts on, I mean, against the backdrop of what you've just said about some pretty troubling actions to date with respect to national security, what this might portend?
Well, you know, Google's got their system called DeepMind, which, you know, has beaten champions in chess and Go, the game of Go. And it did this by unsupervised learning, just like playing the game against itself. It was able to, you know, beat the best champions in the world. And this AI system is different because it's called a transferable AI, where it can take an AI neural net that's generated to solve one particular problem and move that and alter it so that it can solve new problems. And what they're creating is a artificial general intelligence, which is different than the AIs that we've built in the past, which are always specific to a certain problem set. This one will be generic and general, which will be able to solve all problem sets. And the problem that we have with this is that, you know, the person that was a vice president of Google's AI cloud services, Lele Fay, she has, you know, she's opening up a new, well, she opened up a new Chinese Google AI development center. And as she stated in a Google press release, or I think it actually was a blog post, she said that Google's AI has no boundaries or borders. And so the fact, if you take her statement about how Google doesn't have any borders, then that means that, you know, China, Google China will have access to this, you know, AI super weapon.
Very well, super technology that certainly can be weaponized. Zach Voorhees, this is a topic to which we hope we could return to. I can't tell you how much I appreciate both your time today, Zach, and your courage in coming forward. Follow Zach at Perpetual Maniac on Twitter. This is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.